This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, a Nobel Prize laureate from Sydney helps develop a ventilator to battle COVID-19. The man who spearheads the fight against the pandemic, Dr. Robert Strang. We'll fill you in on how to vote in the municipal election and talk about the election with political scientist Tom Urbaniak. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. Sydney's Dr. Art MacDonald is an astrophysicist and Nobel laureate. Now he's part of an international team that has developed a new ventilator to help fight COVID-19. Recently, MacDonald acknowledged a fellow Canadian who won this year's Nobel Prize in Medicine.
You reached out to Michael Houghton of the University of Alberta. He moved to Canada from Britain about 10 years ago, and he's this year's Nobel Prize winner in medicine. And how do you feel when you learned about a fellow Canadian winning the Nobel Prize?
His contribution is very significant in terms of hepatitis C, not an area that I know about from my own expertise, but I've already reached out to him and congratulated him and offered to tell him some of the ways in which his life is likely to change now as a result of this award. But it is really wonderful to see yet another person working in Canada recognized for significant contributions in this way. We had, of course, Donna Strickland at University of Waterloo, and Jim Peebles, who's originally from Manitoba, who is a professor at Princeton and was a colleague of mine when I was there, who received the physics prize last year, and Donna Strickland was also a physics prize.
And, of course, you have first-hand knowledge of how this has changed your life, and what did you tell him?
Started with 1,500 emails in the first 12 hours or so, but thereafter it became really a very busy schedule. That, of course, will be moderated substantially by the COVID situation, but really you get invitations from all over the world to do all kinds of things, and that's very exciting, but it also makes you very busy. And it is difficult, certainly more difficult to carry on your research program when that occurs. I was retired when it occurred for me, but I also was still quite active in research, as I still am, and it had an impact on that as well.
Can you talk about your roots in Sydney, and where did you grow up and go to high school?
It's actually a very wonderful place to grow up. I lived on Milton Street near what was Colby School at the time. It's been replaced since then with a new school, but I then went to Sydney Academy and had a very nice teenage years. There was a group called High Y at the YMCA, which was a service club for teenagers. But it met on Friday evenings, and there was boys' clubs and girls' clubs, and on Friday we would have meetings and a dance afterwards, and on Saturday we organized a dance at the YMCA for which there was a substantial attendance, and it's in fact in that group that I met my wife, Janet MacDonald, who, M.A.C. Donald rather than M.C. Donald, but that's Cape Breton for you. Lots of McDonald's around. And so she lived on Union Street, very close to Sydney Academy. So we have now been married for 54 years this year. And so my growing up in Sydney has led to a very happy life thereafter with my wife.
What is it about the time that you spent in Sydney that led you led to your passion for science and this line of work?
Well, actually, I became most interested in mathematics. At the time I went to Sydney Academy, there was a wonderful teacher, Bob Chafe, who eventually became the principal of the academy. He did extra classes for a number of us that had a particular interest in mathematics, and in fact there are two others in my particular class of 35 or so, which was one of the classes out of a graduating class of 100 to 150, I'm not sure the total, but two others in that class, John Reed and Chris Field, who got PhDs in mathematics, and I got one in physics. So it was quite a remarkable class, actually, in terms of academic achievement thereafter. I went to Dalhousie, and then I knew when I went there that I was going to want to apply the math in some way, and it turned out that physics was the particular area that this mathematics interest and the skills I'd gotten from Bob Chase got amplified and used in experiment and to some degree in theory over the years.
And your bio says you earned a Master's of Science degree in 1965. And how did this build on your foundation to becoming an astrophysicist and then to an area of research, what scientists call the study of neutrinos, and which resulted in you winning a Nobel Prize?
Well, I did a master's degree for a year after graduating with a bachelor's at Dalhousie. And that was in, it was actually in positron annihilation studies, which used nuclear sources in a way that was eventually positron annihilation became a substantial technology, positron emission tomography or PET scanners. 10 years later, not really from the outgrowth of my work, but from many people's work, ended up being a very good medical application. But it was in the nuclear field to the degree of using nuclear radioactive sources to do the measurements. And that then led to me going to Caltech, where really the place I studied at Caltech was in a laboratory headed by Willie Fowler, who actually got a Nobel Prize for having worked out all of the nuclear reactions that power the sun, and stimulated experiments in that area. And so I was interested both in fundamental physics relating to the nucleus and the particles that are emitted from nuclear reactions, and also got interested in astrophysics because clearly that group applied this physics knowledge to trying to understand how the sun burns, which in fact was one of the positive results that we obtained by measuring neutrinos from the sun in our measurements. And so it kind of came naturally just by the connections I made as I went from one educational institution to another.
And your research into neutrinos, is this in the area of being aware of the sun's influence on the Earth and how an understanding of that can result in people learning how to prolong their lives and living a healthier life?
Sure. Well, basically, it turns out that the more you understand about how the world works in a detailed way, the more your life is potentially enhanced by the use of that information to create things that are of value. The PET scanner I mentioned earlier was an early example of that. But in fact, Time magazine chose Albert Einstein as the man of the 20th century because the theory that he put forward made possible lasers, computers, and even his general relativity, as it turns out, is used in the accuracy you get for your GPS. And so basic understanding is valuable in itself. But in particular, knowing in detail how the sun burns, which we did by studying these particles called neutrinos that penetrate substantially, even out from the very dense material in the sun, and we were able to detect them here on Earth. Understanding how the sun burns in detail is of value because these days there's a major attempt to develop what's called fusion energy, which is a way in which you use, heavy water, and as a matter of fact, as a source material of a fuel for this process, where you're trying to create the sun in a bottle. That is, you're trying to confine the enormous temperatures that occur in the center of the sun where nuclei fuse together by using magnetic fields to bend the charged particles that try to get out back into the central region and don't let them touch the walls of the bottle, which would immediately melt. So it's a very sophisticated process. It's something people have been working on for many years. When it is successful, and they're at a point now where within the next 10 years or so, they expect to be able to produce more energy than is necessary to drive the process. When it is successful, there's an almost limitless source of energy in the heavy water that you can extract from the ocean, as people there in Glace Bay know very well from what happened in terms of producing heavy water back in the 1960s.
And what is it that happened in Glace Bay in the 1960s about producing heavy water?
Well, it turns out that, although it's unrelated to what I just described, we used an enormous amount of heavy water as the way of detecting these neutrinos from the sun, which we did using a detector which was 2 kilometers underground in an active mine in Sudbury. But for me, it was quite ironic because the Seaboard Power Plant in Glace Bay, which produced steam by burning coal back in the day, was the source of steam that produced this heavy water, which is typically used in Canadian-style nuclear reactors. And I worked at the Seaboard Power Plant in about, I think, 1961 as a summer student. So for me, the fact that I had worked at a place in Cape Breton that ultimately created some of the excess and therefore available heavy water for us to use in our experiment was kind of an interesting historic connection between me and Cape Breton and the success of our experiment.
What is a neutrino, and why is it important in discovering whether or not they have mass?
Well, neutrinos are one of a set of basic particles that we don't know how to subdivide any further. There are the electrons that run in your electrical circuits and the wires in the wall, if you like. There are protons and neutrons made of things called quarks, and the quarks are what is the basic particle in this case. And those neutrons and protons are in the center or the nucleus of atoms, with electrons going around the outside, and that is the matter from which we and the world around us is made. These neutrinos are unusual particles that are emitted during certain types of radioactive decay, or they're emitted from the sun, from those nuclear reactions powering it. But they have very unusual properties. They have no electric charge, they have a very small mass, and they don't interact very strongly with anything, so they can pass through enormous amounts of material without ever finding the nucleus of an atom that they would have to interact with in order to be affected in any way. And so these neutrinos are outside our normal experience, but in terms of the theory that now seems to work very well at a very fundamental level, they are one of three major components. And so understanding, for example, the way, well, whether they have a finite mass or not, is very fundamental when you're trying to understand their place in this theory. You may have heard of the so-called Higgs boson, for which there was a lot of discussion a number of years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, when it was discovered, and for which a Nobel Prize was also awarded. It produces mass for all of the rest of the quarks and electrons and so on, but neutrinos have a different mechanism that isn't even understood yet. And so us discovering that, in fact, they have a finite mass makes a difference. It also makes a difference in how the universe evolves, because neutrinos are produced in very large quantities in the Big Bang, and so depending on how large a mass they have, the gravitational effects from it can be substantial in how the universe has evolved since the Big Bang. So it's very esoteric and outside of normal experience, but very important when it comes to trying to find the final understanding of how the world works in detail.
So one day back in the spring, you and your colleagues are researching dark matter, and as you quoted, in a matter of days, you started working on a new ventilator for people infected with COVID-19, and it was recently authorized by Health Canada. Can you talk about that project, and how did it get underway?
Well, at the time when COVID was really becoming a problem in various parts of the world, particularly in Italy, some colleagues with whom a number of us here in Canada were working on a future experiment to try to detect dark matter particles, which is another whole subject, but it's something that makes up a large fraction of our universe, and we don't yet understand it in a fundamental way. We use argon gas, liquefied, 200 degrees below zero and forming a liquid. It is involving techniques that are handling gas and purifying gas and controlling it in sophisticated ways using computers. And so my colleague, who was at that point locked down in Milan, called me and said, you know, I think we can use these techniques to build a simple ventilator that could be particularly applicable to COVID-19. It could be fewer parts and therefore more readily able to be supplied by the world supply chain. It can be less expensive, and we can do it open source, so that open license as well. We don't want to try to make money out of it. We simply want to make the world able to do this so that other countries could pick up on the idea and build them if they really run into difficulty. And so what we did was pull together the set of scientists, or some of them, that had been working on this dark matter experiment. I was able to call the head of a particle laboratory, Triumph, in Vancouver, the head of Chalk River Laboratories in Ontario, and our underground laboratory, Snow Lab, and also scientists here at our universities in something called the McDonald Institute that they named. I didn't create it, but they named it after me. And this group of people had expertise in a variety of different parts of our project, ranging from understanding how to control gases to providing very safe software to control this ventilator. And we were able, over a period of about 4 months, to come up with a device that works very well. We submitted it to Health Canada, and last week they announced that it was authorized for use here in Canada, and there will be 10,000 of them produced in response to a government contract, which will become available for use here in Canada, or potentially, if hopefully we're able to control COVID-19 to a greater degree, we may not need so many here in Canada and can help the rest of the world. with them as well, and while retaining a stockpile in Canada that could be valuable for something similar in the future. It's nice that these wonderful people that responded to this process were willing to devote their time and skill to do this on a totally humanitarian basis. We worked with Dexos in Ontario to produce the devices, and they are now well into the process of ramping up their manufacturing to supply this contract.
So the new ventilator is basically a simpler design with the same impact or ability to treat COVID-19 symptoms.
Well, the idea of the ventilator we're dealing with was to make it very simple, as I said, so we'd have something like 50 parts rather than 1,500 in the more sophisticated devices. But that can be enough to do what you need to do for COVID. Basically, you have a supply of oxygen that you want to control in a very sophisticated way using software, computer software, so that you open an inlet valve and allow the oxygen to come in at a fixed pressure and for a fixed period of time, and then close that valve and open an exhalation valve that allows the patient to breathe. You can either take over breathing for the patient if they're very ill, or you can supplement the oxygen that they're receiving as they breathe themselves. And therein lies the complexity of it, is trying to control the flow of the oxygen to the patient. But in addition, you have to make sure that it's 100% safe and reliable for the longer term, and therefore a lot of safety relief valves, a lot of careful alarms set if things are not working appropriately for the patient. And that sort of thing was something that the people that associated with Canadian Nuclear Laboratories, Chalk River, are very expert at, because they're trying to do it in completely safe ways for controlling nuclear reactors. So we had a tremendous advantage in having them as a part of our team.
And thanks so much for your time, Dr. McDonald. It was a great privilege to speak with you.
Well, it's a pleasure for me. I have very pleasant memories of Cape Breton. I love the place. I took all my kids, of which there are four, and grandkids, which a large fraction of our 9 grandkids came with us, and we came down and toured, went around the trail, and just really enjoyed being back in Cape Breton again. So one of my favorite places in the world. So it's a pleasure to speak with you.
He's the guy who calls the shots on COVID-19 regulations, and by now, a very recognizable figure, this province's Chief Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Robert Strang. As he tells Dialogue, we've been lucky so far preventing a second wave of COVID-19, but we have to keep up the fight. And it's especially important to get a flu vaccine this year.
Oh, well, I mean, we have certainly training and experience, and every day we deal with, you know, a range of public health issues that we have to, you know, communicate to the public or engage, you know, decision makers within government. But many of us have dealt with previous, you know, large outbreaks, or some of us were, some of my colleagues were around during H1N1 10 years ago. But this was certainly at a whole different level in terms of, I guess, the size and the scope and the intensity of the work for chief medical officers, certainly during the first wave.
What kind of thought and preparation is involved for you and your colleagues when making decisions that affect so many people? And those decisions, it can be the difference between someone being healthy or being very sick.
Well, I think two things. I mean, we're as public health preventive medicine physicians, we're trained, like our population is, you know, groups of people. So my patient population is all Nova Scotians. Whereas a, you know, a family doctor, their patient population would be all the individuals that they see, maybe 3,000. So we're used to dealing with thinking about things from communities and the whole province. For me, certainly, and I know from my other colleagues as well, that we're very cognizant of everything we were putting in place to control the spread of COVID-19 had its own set of significant impacts, some of which we anticipated, but as we've learned, some which we couldn't anticipate at the time. So that I still find that perhaps one of the heaviest part of doing leading this pandemic response is trying to find a balance, knowing that everything we do on either side, there are significant health and social and economic implications. So I'm not naive at all to in terms of the understanding of what it means to kind of shut down large parts of the economy. And we've seen the impacts that that has. But if we hadn't have done that, we would have had equally or greater, more serious impacts of widespread of COVID. What's happening now in Ontario with, you know, Ottawa and Toronto, their health system is becoming absolutely gridlocked. And that in itself has huge health and economic and social implications. Finding the right balance, knowing that there are significant impacts either side of the equation. I'm trained in public health. I'm not trained in the economy and finances up, but my job was to provide the good advice and help government make, you know, the best decisions possible. It was certainly, quite frankly, and we know a lot more now about the virus. We know a lot more about how having a more nuanced and refined response. But back in February, March, there was a lot of things we didn't know about the virus, and there were some very serious predictions about how bad things could get, and I think necessarily across the country we shut things down, across the board, a hard stop, if you will, and then we've slowly reopened. Our goal is to not have to do that hard stop again because of the impacts, the many, many negative impacts of that very hard stop, and also we know that again, the balancing, we can't, lots of people won't get seriously ill from COVID, but if we let it go without a lot of controls, there'll be large numbers of people who do get severely ill and large numbers of preventable deaths. And as I said earlier, which will, uncontrolled spread of COVID would absolutely paralyze and gridlock our healthcare system. And then you have to think about all the people looking for health care for all their other health needs that wouldn't be able to access care in a timely manner.
Federal officials recently talked about the possibility of the fall being worse for COVID in a second wave than what Canadians experienced in the spring. And is Nova Scotia in a position of winding down from a first wave and entering the second by this point?
Well, I think we're fortunate in throughout Atlantic Canada that we've been since end of May into June, since we've actually been out of our first wave. We have yet to experience a resurgence, return, if you will, the second wave. Our hope collectively, and certainly in Nova Scotia, is that the combination of maintaining our border restrictions, and I think more and more people are both within and outside our jurisdiction are looking at the border restrictions and the requirement to quarantine when people come into Nova Scotia as a very important measure to maintain. So having controls of our borders, making sure that we have good access to testing, and we're making sure that people have we have things in place so people can have timely access to testing. And then the third piece is maintaining the level of restrictions that we have right now. Many people are saying, well, we're safe. COVID's not here. Why can't we relax? Well, the reality is that for the next coming weeks to few months, that when things kind of are swirling a bit out of control around us, we, along with controlling our borders and testing and follow-up by public health, we need all Nova Scotians to stick with what has kept us relatively safe so far in this pandemic. Now is not the time to let our guard down and start to relax. In fact, it's right now we need to strengthen our resolve to all of us to protect each other by doing all the things around social distancing, distancing, masking, following all the public health rules and the recommendations around hand washing, et cetera, because that's what we will get more COVID coming into the province. But if we're all doing all those things together and following the public health rules and requirements, that's what prevents the COVID from getting a foothold and spreading widely in our communities. If we can have isolated, sporadic cases with limited spread, we can control it, and it won't get out of control. But that takes all those measures, border, the public health system testing and public health follow-up, but it also requires all Nova Scotians to be COVID safe, if you will, and to really be thoughtful about it, especially our social lives, the number of people we gather with, how we gather, those kind of pieces. Those are critically important that we maintain those when we're thinking about the weeks and next couple of months ahead.
Has the province received many complaints from Nova Scotians or businesses about shoppers required to wear a mask in public places?
There's some. I mean, it certainly wouldn't come to me. I've heard some businesses are saying, just can we kind of relax the rules around social distancing and things. I think by and large, most people are adhering to the requirements around masking. There's always some people who don't have a valid medical reason, but are just saying, well, I'm not going to wear a mask. We don't really have a way to, we haven't asked for health certificates on that. That's really not feasible. And so we're saying we have to take people's, if they say they can't wear masks, we have to take that at face value. But at the same time, we're asking all Nova Scotians to not abuse that, if you will, and to really to wear a mask if at all possible. And I think by and large, that is working well. We are getting some sense, certainly some communication that people are getting tired of wearing a mask. But that's why it's important. We have to understand why we need to continue to do things like social distancing, like wearing masks in indoor public places, because that's what will keep us safe in the weeks and the couple of months to come.
And of course, coming up to the flu and the cold season, is the health department concerned about people confusing those symptoms with symptoms of the coronavirus?
Certainly, that's going to be one of our challenges. Is to, first of all, for individuals who have the general flu-like symptoms, which could be influenza, could be COVID, could be some other virus, we're going to have to make sure that these people are tested, because we want to make sure we rule out that they don't have COVID. And that's one of the reasons why we're saying it's going to be extra important that people get their flu vaccine this year, because the flu vaccine will greatly decrease the chance that what they're having, symptoms they're having are due to flu. And so hopefully we'll have fewer people seeking medical care, or fewer people confused about their symptoms simply because they've been protected by the flu vaccine. The other piece is we need to make sure I have to understand that every year the flu season puts a strain on our healthcare system. And so, again, that's another reason why we need as many people as possible to get their flu vaccine, because we have to anticipate there's going to be extra strain on the healthcare system from COVID. And if we have a lot of people also needing healthcare because of influenza, that's going to be a very, very challenging situation.
There have been many people who said they didn't have a cold or a flu in a very long time, like they normally would since COVID started, because they have been doing things like washing their hands more often and social distancing. Are you seeing those trends too?
That's certainly something we're hopeful about. We know that in Australia they had a very mild flu season simply because they had very tight COVID restrictions at the same time they normally get flu. So you're right. Whatever we do that minimizes the chance of COVID to spread will also have will make it much harder for influenza to spread around. But I want people to understand that just because we're hoping for that doesn't mean that we don't need to take extra seriously the need to get a flu vaccine this fall.
Do you think, political stripes aside and regardless of what level of government, that this is one issue where elected officials can find common ground?
I think that is one of the hallmarks of the success to date of the COVID response in Canada compared to our neighbors to the south and some other countries where we have not at all politicized COVID, and we're regardless of party affiliation or whatever, in government, all governments are working collaboratively and working to following public health to do what's needed to minimize the impact of COVID.
This municipal election in CBRM is very different than others. There are no paper ballots, internet and telephone voting only. Deborah Campbell Ryan is the returning officer and municipal clerk, the person in charge of making sure the voting takes place and runs smoothly. Deborah, first of all, tell us what's different about this election than any other one in CBRM.
Well, what's different and what's new is that there are no paper ballots. For this election, it's all electronic, which means voting either by telephone or the internet. And what's not new is electronic voting, because we've had it for the last two general elections and a by-election during our advance polls. So for those advance polls, we had all electronic elections as well, the telephone and internet, no paper, and very well received by the electorate.
Yeah, it has gone over quite well, hasn't it? People are getting used to it, would you say?
Oh, I think so. I think they would expect it. I think they'd be disappointed if we didn't offer it.
It's the convenience-wise, it makes it easier for a lot of people, whether they be elderly, disabled, or whatever, to get to vote, first of all, right?
Yes, that's correct. It's very convenient. It's very accessible.
How many people are eligible this time around?
We have approximately 81,600 people on our voters list, eligible voters.
So election night for you this year will be somewhat different, though, because of the no paper ballots for everybody. Does that translate into making it easier?
It is easier. I mean, we have a lot of work up front, of course, and we did in previous elections with the advance poll. We're working with our service provider, so there's a lot of work we do in advance. The election night will be much easier from an administrative point of view, and I think the candidates will appreciate it as well. We should have the results shortly after the polls close. So when I say the polls, the electronic voting ends at 7 p.m. on October 17th. So once the polls close and that our service provider, Intellivote, confirms that all voters are finished and out of the system, they will shut the system down. So we do have the voter help locations on election day, one in each division. We will confirm with our staff there that everyone that's there at 7 will have the opportunity to vote. And then there's a verification process with the auditor. We have an auditor that's required. And then we will post the results on the website.
You can vote from those centers?
You can vote. We're encouraging people to call us. We're calling them voter help centers. Really, they are for people who might not have received a PIN, might have lost their letter, or anybody that needs assistance voting. But we can help them. We have a voter help desk set up. It's in operation right now. It runs regular business hours, and it'll be open all day on election day, 563-8009, phone here. And we can pretty much help people get through the process of the online voting. The telephone voting is very easy. It's an automated system and step-by-step instructions as you go through the process.
You should have, most people, would have received their PIN by now, correct?
The letters, yes, they started hitting the street a week and a half ago. Again, we have the ability to add people to the voters list right up to the close of polls on election night. So everybody will have the opportunity. Those who are entitled to vote will have the opportunity to vote.
So even if you didn't get your PIN by mail, you'll still get the opportunity to vote.
That's correct. Just like you would with a paper ballot, if you didn't receive a voter card, you go to the polling station, you get added to the list. Now, there is an oath required to verify that you are qualified to vote, and then you will have the opportunity to vote. So at that point, somebody could take their PIN and go home and vote if they like, but we will have a computer set up for people who require assistance or would prefer to vote there.
In the past, you know, I can remember some election coverage nights that it took hours for votes to be counted and so on. You don't expect that to be the case this time around.
No, like I said, once we confirm that everybody that's in the system has had the opportunity to vote, then we will go through that verification process. It'll only take about 10 or 15 minutes by the time we close the system down, print the results, and they're all instant. Like, it's the full report comes out for all contests. And then we were going to enter that information on the website as we would normally do. So, if we have the polls closed at 7, we get our reports printed, and enter this on the system, I'm thinking 30 minutes.
And we'll know the results in that time.
Yes, the full election results within 30 minutes. So, I mean, I remember elections, past elections as well. And the polls reporting, you know, there might be 14 ballot boxes in one center, and you might have 10 of 14, and you're waiting for those last four. There might be issues with the counting and such, but the system counts the ballots, so it's much faster.
Yeah, I imagine it would be. Looking forward to that myself. We can get the results much quicker. Has this been, you know, for your staff and that sort of thing, has it, as you said, you've done it in the past. It really hasn't been that much of a change, has it?
No, it's exactly the same. We've used IntelliVote for all three of those elections that I referenced. And they guide us along. They have a timeline that we work by, and they remind us, okay, this is due today, this is due. Like, we have to proof the ballots, we have to proof the telephone ballots, the recordings of the names and such. So all through the process, they guide us. So, yeah, we're used to that.
With six candidates for mayor, and off the top of your head, how many for council seats?
We have 57 candidates in total, so that would be six for mayor, and we have two CSAP, that's the French School Board, so we have 49 for council.
But again, the number really doesn't matter with electronic voting, does it? I mean, it's not going to be any harder.
Oh gosh, no.
Yeah.
No, it won't be. No.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be. It sounds like it's going to be quick, and it sounds like it's going to be. Not very complicated in terms of the voter themselves. It's easier.
It is easy. Yes, very easy. And again, I know in the tradition, it wasn't an easy decision for council because of the traditional paper ballot, and especially Cape Bretoners, we like tradition. So, but given the COVID and the public health protocols with respect to that pandemic, they made that decision for the safety of the electors and the safety of election workers.
Depending on how this goes, do you think we'd see a return to paper ballots?
Well, I can't see it going away. I can't see them not having that option to vote. It'll depend on the next council, of course, and what they decide, because it is their decision.
What's the traditional turnout in municipal elections in CBRN?
Well, we've had varied turnouts, because there are a lot of things that affect a voter turnout. And, for instance, the mayoralty race is a big one, the number of acclamations, the weather, and you might recall back in 2016, 5 days before the election, we had floodsgiving. So the weather does affect. So with e-voting, I mean, you have the ability to vote from the comfort of your home, so weather hopefully wouldn't impact, depending on if there was a hurricane or something blew through. But again, that would be something we would consult with our officials in Halifax on if that was impacting our election. But we have found that electronic voting doesn't really improve voter turnout. It doesn't increase it. People who are interested in voting usually vote.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Yeah. So in 2016, for instance, just to throw some numbers out, we had 53% voter turnout, which is very good. Halifax, I think, typically has about 33%. And of those who voted, 50% used the telephone or the internet.
So you've had your job as returning officers start with the election call and so on, the writ being issued, and now the election. But the biggest part of your job is probably coming your way with all the new candidates that are going to be there, the new councillors, because there's a record number, right?
Yes, sir. Well, six. We have six new council members for sure that we know of.
Yeah.
So, yes, the orientation process is going to be the next stage after we complete this election process, for sure.
Your work is just beginning.
It is.
Deborah, thanks very much for taking the time out of your day to talk with us, and good luck, and we'll be seeing the results on election night.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dave, for the opportunity.
If you have any questions about voting, you should call the Voter Helpline, 902-563-8009. Still on the subject of this year's municipal vote, Dialogue spoke with CBU political science professor Tom Urbaniak about electronic voting and holding an election during a pandemic. Tom, this is the first time in CBRM that there will be no paper ballots. You don't go out and vote, exercise your franchise. What does that mean to the democratic system in terms of voting in this election?
This is a different election, even though we had the experience, and many voters last time in CBRM voted electronically. This time, the overwhelming majority of voters will cast their ballots electronically. there still is a paper ballot option available at City Hall on Election Day in Glace Bay and in North Sydney. But essentially everyone is being directed wherever possible to the electronic option. So this is a communications challenge for the organizers of the election, and that responsibility falls to the municipal clerk and her assistants, and to the candidates as well, to make sure that voters whom they are reaching know how to vote, and that there's that follow-up with the voters that, in fact, any pledged votes are being cast. So I'm going to be watching with some interest to see how this affects the voter turnout and whether there are any glitches along the road. Early indications are positive, though. On day one of the electronic voting, October the 7th, the voter turnout across the municipality was just over 10%, and that's very good.
It is. It is usually higher in this area in Cape Breton. We've seen some pretty low turnouts in Halifax, down in the 30-some, high 30 percentage rate. Does this mean, you know, does the electronic voting of it, does that in the future mean that maybe we can get more people out to vote?
As people get used to electronic voting, this will become the norm for local elections. I think there always will be still another option, an in-person option, but the norm from now on, COVID or no COVID, pandemic or no pandemic, will be the electronic voting. And as people become accustomed to it, I think it will have at least a modest positive impact on the voter turnout. There has been a little bit of research in other jurisdictions that have a longer experience with electronic voting in local elections, some municipalities in Ontario, for example, and the results generally, although mixed, but generally taken together, have shown a modest positive impact on overall voter turnout.
Candidate-wise, you know, the old style, walking up, knocking on your door, shaking your hand, going in for a cup of tea, has gone out the door with COVID. Does that make a difference?
Yes, it does. So in-person contact is critical in local elections. Social media is a factor, but social media, generally speaking, does not determine the results of local elections. So you could monitor closely the social media traffic and discourse and come to a conclusion about who is dominating the discussion and who is likely to win, only to be surprised on election night or when the ballots are tallied to find that the result is very different, because local politics is still very much a friends and neighbors, in-person, direct contact type of exercise. Even in the COVID election, even this year, serious candidates have realized this. And so there's not as much doorstep conversation, very little of that. But they're still trying to reach out by telephone. They're still trying to hold some sort of virtual meetings. They still know that they have to have those conversations with the voters. Where there's that direct contact, there's a much better chance of securing the vote.
Pretty hard to get that, though, when you're standing on the side of a road with a mask on or on a phone trying to make that connection.
Absolutely, and that has made it a little bit more difficult for challengers in cases where the incumbents are running, because the incumbents always have an advantage, that being name recognition and that being having amassed a little bit of a track record of dealing with constituency issues and complaints. So a challenger is usually starting from behind and actually usually needs as many opportunities for personal conversation and contact as possible. So this election has, on balance, made it a little bit more difficult for the challengers.
Depending on who you talk to, signs matter or they don't matter?
Signs matter. I wish I could respond otherwise, especially because a proliferation, a forest of these signs can be very wasteful. But name recognition in local elections is really, really critical. And those of us who are close council watchers, you know, sometimes are a little too close in the sense that we realize that particular personalities? Have they distinguished themselves through policy proposals or through being particularly articulate or vocal on the council? And we think, aha, this is resonating with the public. But actually, there's a huge swath of the public that only pays casual attention to the constant goings-on at council. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the local election campaign, especially when there are a number of options in front of the public, multi-candidate races, you've got to get your name in front of the public, and the signs do help that. There are no political parties running in local elections. That's another reason why name recognition becomes so critical. So I hope we will, as a community, sort of evolve into ways where name recognition can happen without so many of these signs. But right now, the stark reality is that signs do count for something.
In some provinces, I do believe anyway, that during either provincial or federal elections, lawn signs are banned.
Right, and some municipalities even have bylaws banning them. That's true.
Something to look at in the future, maybe?
Well, especially as more of us become comfortable with the online discourse, where you could have these virtual signs, if you will, of virtual ways of reaching people, then the importance of signs will decline, and you won't be putting the challengers at a disadvantage by restricting this proliferation of signs.
One good sign, pun intended, mm-hmm. is that you have a large number of candidates running, 6 for mayor, 49 for council, include. I think one council seat has 8 people vying for it. That's a good sign.
It is. It is. It's a little bit challenging for the voters. So if you take a case like District 11, you have the 8 candidates running. None of them is the incumbent. So you have 8 people sort of just trying to increase their profile, trying to get a few policy ideas in front of the public in a relatively short time. Because if you think about nomination day, registration day, just a little over a month ago, and that is when some of the candidates step forward at the last moment, and now we're already into the voting period. So it's like a long election day. And then we have the COVID restrictions. So in a multi-candidate race, that's a tough situation for the voters, sort of trying to distinguish between these candidates, who leans this way, who leans that way, what are actually their priorities, or is this just a popularity contest based on whom I recognize the most or whom I might have met at one point in the past and with whom I had a good conversation. So I wouldn't be surprised if in some of these multi-candidate races, especially where the incumbent is not running, where the winner might have 30% or less of the vote. Because remember, this is not a majority of votes. This is first past the post. All you have to do is come in first place.
I'm sure as a political scientist in the past, you've spent some periods of time waiting and waiting for that final poll to report and those final ballots to be cast. I know I have. This is not going to be the case this time. It's almost instant.
It's almost instant. That's right. Exactly. But I wouldn't be surprised if here and there will be automatic or requested recounts because of close results.
Tom, thanks very much. Always interesting talking to you, and we'll be watching on election night to see just how well this whole thing works.
For sure. Always a pleasure, Dave. Thanks.
And that's our show for this week. You can contact us at info@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.